Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today, either in the room or on the webcast. Before we start, I would just draw your attention to the usual forward-looking statement. In terms of our agenda today, we've got hopefully quite a full and interesting day. We'll start off with our Q4 results, and then Gavin will talk about our strategy and our outlook. We then have presentations from Tony and the team around cost transformation and the integration of EE, and then you'll hear from each of the CEOs of our lines of business. During the breaks, during lunch, do have a look at the demonstrations outside, and also during the lunch break, there'll be an opportunity to meet some of the new CEOs on the operating committee, perhaps with a slightly different twist. With that, I'll hand you over to our chairman, Sir Michael Wake.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us today. This, as you know, has been a landmark year for BT in many ways. In January, we completed our acquisition of EE, the U.K.'s leading mobile operator, and we are delighted with how the integration process is going and how the business has been doing since, and indeed before it joined BT. This is a transformational deal for us. It means we have the best mobile network and the largest super-fast broadband network in the United Kingdom. Our financial performance has also been strong this year. We have delivered our best revenue performance for more than 7 years, and this has been driven by the investments we have been making in the business, whether that's our investment in Champions League, BT Mobile, or new security services to protect organizations against the growing risk of cyberattacks. Our most important investment has been in fiber broadband. This year, Openreach achieved the milestone of bringing our network to more than 25 million premises. That means we have helped bring fiber broadband to 90% of the U.K., and this has been one of the fastest deployments of fiber broadband anywhere in the world. Rollout has been on budget and ahead of schedule. The U.K. now has the highest fiber broadband availability of major European countries. It has some of the lowest prices, and it has been the largest internet economy of the G20 countries. Openreach's investment in fiber has been key to this progress. It was a bold investment, started at a time when many said there would be little demand, and at a time when there was no other private investment taking place of this scale. Being part of the wider group has given Openreach the confidence and ability to invest at scale and pace. It has also given Openreach access to some of the world's leading research facilities, which are shaping the way broadband and networks are evolving. While our investment in fiber has been a success for the U.K., we have not done as well on providing a customer experience that matches their rising expectations. This is an area that the board is very focused on, and we recognize there is a lot more that we need to do and will do, as Gavin will go through later. Some have suggested that structurally separating out Openreach would increase investments in the network and in service. This is simply not the case. Separation would result in a riskier business with less investment, not more. We want to invest further and to do so at pace. We stand ready to deliver the minimum broadband speeds needed for every home to enjoy the most popular internet services. We want to expand the reach of fiber broadband beyond the government's current target of 95%. We want to take the U.K. from a super-fast nation to an ultra-fast one. In order to do this, we need regulatory support and the right policy framework to make sure we can earn an appropriate return for our shareholders. This year, we have sought to reward our shareholders by again paying a progressive dividend, as you can see on the chart. I'm pleased to be able to announce today a final dividend of 9.6p, bringing the full-year dividend to 14p, which represents a growth of 13%. In terms of our dividend going forward, we remain confident in our future cash generation. We therefore expect to grow the dividend by at least 10% for each of the next 2 years. We will do this at the same time as investing in our business to drive further revenue and cash flow growth in the years ahead. With that, I'll now pass you to Tony to take you through the financial results for the year. Thank you.
Morning, everyone. Thanks, Mike.
We delivered a strong financial performance this year, with our revenue growth at the top end of our outlook range and the best in more than 7 years. And our EBITDA and cash flow also showed good growth. It met outlook and it beat consensus. Our investments in EE, fiber, BT Sport, BT Mobile, and our new business products have continued to deliver strong financial returns. We made good progress in cost transformation this year, and this continues to be further opportunity for savings. So, how does our performance stack up against our outlook? When we set our outlook last year, it was on a standalone BT basis, excluding EE. So here we've shown BT's results on exactly the same basis. As you can see, we've comfortably met our outlook on all three key measures. Our key revenue measure, underlying revenue, excluding transit, was up 2% at the top end of our outlook range. EBITDA comfortably met our outlook of modest growth, up 1%, whilst normalized free cash flow was $2.84 billion against our outlook of around $2.8 billion. So, a strong financial performance here as well. Now, if we move on to our reported results for the quarter and the year for the enlarged BT group. We have 2 months of EE results included here, and this is the largest driver behind the strong growth rate. The raised net debt figure largely reflects the debt raised and taken on as part of the EE acquisition, which I'll cover in more detail later. This slide gives you a more detailed breakdown of our performance in the fourth quarter, showing standalone BT, EE's contribution for the 2 months of the quarter, and then the combined group. The standalone BT revenue was up 1% and up 1.3% on an underlying ex-transit basis. This reflected growth in consumer, Openreach, and business. EBITDA was flat. If you remember last year, we benefited from around £30 million of ladder pricing in the fourth quarter. Without this, our EBITDA would have been up 2%. EBITDA in the quarter was also impacted by some other headwinds we have previously called out, such as lever costs and our first-year investment in BT Sport Europe. In terms of capitalized expenditure and normalized free cash flow, these were both broadly in line with last year for BT standalone. We're very pleased with EE's performance for the 2 months. It delivered a particularly strong performance on cash flow, but I would caution that much of this was timing. And I'll explain later some of this timing related to the emergency services contract. Having looked at the results for this year in some detail, I want to put this into wider context for you. These three charts show how we've performed in the last five financial years, as our investments in our network, products and services have paid off. Our key measure of revenue, underlying revenue excluding transit, has turned around from a 3% decline 3 years ago to 2% growth this year. And we've also seen consistent growth in our EBITDA and normalized free cash flow. This demonstrates what we've been saying for some time, that some of the costs that we take out of the business are reinvested to drive top-line growth, while other savings flow through to the bottom line. Our operating costs this year reflect the investments we've made for growth, in particular the launch of BT Sport. A year ago, I called out a number of headwinds we would face this year. Operating costs, including the launch of BT Sport Europe, a higher pension operating charge, lever costs moving above the line, and no benefit this year from the sale of redundant copper. Excluding these, our underlying operating costs are down 2% for the year. Within this, our underlying labor costs, excluding EE, have reduced by 4%. Despite investing in new engineering and customer service resources and insourcing 2,300 roles into the company. We'll speak in more detail later this morning about our cost transformation and integrating E. I just wanted to highlight two key numbers to you. About a year and a half ago, we told you that we could still see opportunities for more than £1 billion of gross cost savings across the business. Since then, we've delivered a significant proportion of these savings through our cost transformation projects. But we also found and discovered many new opportunities. So as of today, we still have visibility of well over £1 billion of gross cost saving opportunities to be delivered over the next 2 years, with the majority coming this year. And this only counts the savings that we've already identified as of today and excludes the EE integration savings. So I'm very confident in our continued opportunities here. Secondly, when we announced the acquisition of EE in February last year, we said we could see cost synergies with a run rate of £360 million per year. Following our initial operating reviews, we now believe the cost synergies are around 10% higher at around £400 million per year. And we believe the cost of integrating EE will be around 10% lower than we previously expected, at around £550 million per year, rather than the £600 million we'd originally guided. Now, I'd like to move on to talk about how each of our lines of business did this quarter, starting with Global Services. Underlying revenue, excluding transit, was down 2%. This reflected the phasing of the public sector contracts that we've spoken about before. EBITDA was up 5% and up 1% excluding FX, with our cost transformation activities offsetting the revenue decline. We said earlier this year that we expected the growth for the second half of the year, and we'll deliver that with EBITDA up 6% for the half year. Free cash flow for the year, which is a key metric for Global Services, was up 36% due to lower capex and better working capital. The chart on the right shows EBITDA less capex, which is a proxy for cash flow that avoids the fluctuations in working capital. This shows a significant improvement over the past 5 years. Order book for the year was down 4%, reflecting some large contract re-signed we had in quarter four last year. However, in terms of mix, we've seen an improved mix with the majority of orders being new or contract growth, rather than simply renewals. The overall increase in new or contract growth orders this year was 8%. Turning to business, we had a good performance on revenue and EBITDA this quarter. Underlying revenue, excluding transit, was up 2%, and EBITDA was up 11%. But both of these benefited from some one-offs and some seasonal revenue, so you shouldn't expect the same level of growth going forward. However, we've had good financial base for the business. We've once again seen strong growth in IP products, with a 62% growth in IP lines, offsetting around a fifth of the loss in traditional lines. Free cash flow was 6% lower, reflecting the working capital timing for the capital investments last year in fleet vehicles to support the Openreach business. Now, on to consumer. Quarter four revenues was up 8%, driven by a 20% increase in broadband and TV revenue, and also helped by BT Mobile, which has now reached more than 400,000 subscribers since we launched it in March last year. We're very pleased with BT Mobile's performance, and the level of take-up has given us the confidence to launch mobile handsets in the coming year, which John will tell you about in more detail later on. EBITDA was down 2%, which is lower than quarter three, which benefited from the timing of price changes. However, this reflects the launch of BT Sport Europe and our ongoing investment in customer service. This quarter, our shares of broadband net adds, excluding EE, was 72%. We've continued to see strong fibre take-up with 204,000 net adds this quarter, meaning 48% of our customer base now takes fibre. The chart on the right shows our quarterly change in the number of consumer lines.
This quarter, we lost 18,000, bringing the total for the year to 123,000. Less than half of last year's level, which is a very good result. The success of our investment in BT Sport Europe has been reflected in our net TV net adds, which were up 27% this quarter and up 88% for the year. And we can also see it in our BT Sport audience, which is up 45% for the season to date and passed 2 million peak viewers for the first time. Now, looking at EE, we're really pleased with the strength of the EE teams that have joined us and the dynamic culture they bring to the company. EE's management continue to run the business exceedingly well in the period between us agreeing the acquisition and the transaction actually going through. That momentum has now continued. As EE joined BT on the 29th of January, we've included 2 months' performance within our numbers, and we're very pleased with the financial performance so far. On the operational side, it added 54,000 postpaid net adds and recorded postpaid churn of 1.1%, which is in line with recent quarters. He has continued to win awards as the UK's leading mobile operator, topping 5 out of 6 rankings in both the Root Metrics and Open Signal tests. And its network was 60% faster than the nearest competitor in the Speed Test Awards. Looking now at wholesale. As we flagged to you previously, wholesale had a tough comparator this quarter due to ladder pricing revenue of around £30 million it recognised in Q4 last year. Including this quarter's underlying revenue and EBITDA is broadly flat. And you can see this in the EBITDA chart on the right-hand side. And now to Openreach. Revenue was up 2% for the quarter and the year, despite a circa £30 million impact from regulation in the quarter, bringing the total for the year to around £130 million. However, the severity of the winter floods contributed to a 4% increase in operating costs this quarter, leaving EBITDA for the quarter flat. Net CapEx was up 34%, partly due to the deferral of grant funding. This was in line with our guidance that 15-16 Openreach CapEx would be higher than the previous year. Excluding any impact of grant funding, gross CapEx was up 5%, and we expect growth again in 16-17. We added 415,000 net fibre connections, bringing the total to 5.9 million homes and businesses connected. Around 23% of premises passed across the country. However, the take-up we've seen within BDUK areas has been even higher. When we first started rolling out fibre, our original base case was based on 20% penetration. But the market-wide demand for fibre meant earlier this year we hit that figure and revised our take-up assumption to 30% within BDUK areas. We continue to see growing demand, and so this quarter we're revising our expectations higher again to 33% in BDUK areas. In BDUK contracts, if the take-up is better than we expected and surpasses the 20% in our original business case, we will either give back or reinvest some of the grant funding we receive, with the vast majority expected to be reinvested to increase the reach and the quality of the network. So, since quarter four last year, we've been deferring some of the grant funding we've received, and the total deferred to date is 258 million, of which 229 million was deferred during this financial year and 70 million in quarter four. In terms of how that's accounted for within our group CapEx figures for the year, the 229 million we deferred during this financial year effectively increases our accrued CapEx by that amount. It's worth saying that this deferral doesn't impact cash flow in the period, but will be gradually phased over a number of years as we deploy the grant funding income to further expand our network. This has contributed to a 14% increase in our CapEx this year, which totaled $2.65 billion. Excluding the impact of the deferral and EE's 2 months of CapEx, our CapEx for the year is broadly flat. Within this, we've seen a changing mix of spend, with material increases in fiber investment. Openreach growth CapEx is up 5%, but we've seen lower CapEx in the other lines of business due to lower BT fleet CapEx and efficiencies. We've completed the exercise of allocating the EE purchase price against goodwill and intangible assets. And therefore, taking this into account, in 16-17, we expect depreciation to be around $3.6 billion, reflecting a full year's depreciation of EE. Moving on to net debt now, which is up $4.7 billion in the year. This reflects a $3.5 billion cash element of the consideration for EE, as well as the $2.1 billion of EE net debt we took on. Consequently, interest charges for 16-17 will be higher as we have a full year of EE's numbers. But as we reduce our debt over the following years, we expect our annual interest payments for 18-19 to be around $150 million lower than in 16-17. I'll very briefly touch on the pension. The IAS 19 valuation of the pension deficit this quarter is $5.2 billion net of tax, down from $6.1 billion a year ago. This reflects deficit payments of $880 million made during the year. Now, moving on to regulation. In April, Ofcom published the final conclusions of its business connectivity market review. This includes the pricing to apply to Ethernet lines for the roughly 3 years till March 2019. We expect this to have an impact in 16-17 of between 175 and 200 million on Openreach. As some of this is internal, the group impact will be significantly lower. In addition, Ofcom has introduced minimum service levels for the provision and repair of Ethernet, similar to what we already have for copper lines, and it specified that Openreach needs to introduce a dark fibre product for providers of high-speed lease lines for businesses from October 2017. You'll be aware in February, Ofcom gave its initial conclusions from its review of the UK's digital communications market. For the past 5 years, we've made our ducks and poles available to other CPs, which they can use to invest in their own networks. Ofcom have now asked Openreach to provide a digital map of the network in order to encourage take-up. With regard to Openreach, BT has proposed a new governance structure to Ofcom, and we remain in discussions with them on how we can produce a strengthened proportional form of functional separation that's in the best interest of customers, the industry, and investment in UK PLC. Before I give you our full year outlook, I wanted to talk you through the drivers of cash flow for the next 2 years. In 16-17, consumer will be launching handsets and is making this offering to BT mobile customers, the investment for which will impact cash flow by around £100 million. As I just mentioned, we'll see increased headwinds from regulation. We didn't spend as much CapEx on EE's emergency services network contract this year as we expected to, so we'll have a bit more next year and expect up to £300 million in the year. In addition, we'll have around £100 million of integration CapEx relating to the EE acquisition that has to be accounted for under trading cash flow. This is part and parcel of the total integration budget. However, we'll see improved trading, and obviously we'll have a full year of EE's cash flow. So consequently, we expect cash flow for 16-17 to be between £3.1 and £3.2 billion. Adjusting for the consumer handset investment and integration CapEx, this represents an upgrade in the underlying cash flow of around 5%. Moving on to 17-18 cash flow, ESN CapEx will be around £200 million lower than the previous years. In addition, we'll see the payback on the mobile handset investment and a continued improvement in trading, resulting in increased cash flow of more than £3.6 billion. This also includes a further £100 million of integration CapEx, so represents an underlying upgrade of around £150 million. So, to finish, I'd like to show you our full-year outlook for 16-17 and 17-18. Our confidence in our strategy and the investments we're making in our business mean we expect growth in underlying revenue, excluding transit, in both 16-17 and 17-18. In 16-17, adjusted EBITDA is expected to be around $7.9 billion, after the net investment of around $100 million in launching handset offerings to BT Mobile customers, with growth in 17-18 as our investments start to pay back. And as I've just explained, the cash generation for our investments mean we expect normalized free cash flow for 16-17 to be between $3.1 billion and $3.2 billion, rising to above $3.6 billion in 17-18, after around a further £100 million of integration capex. The strength of our cash flows allow us to commit to growing our dividend per share by at least 10% for the next 2 years. Finally, over the past few years, we've made buybacks of around £300 million each year to offset the dilution from employee share schemes. In the coming years, the scheme maturing is smaller, so for 16-17, we plan to buy back around £200 million of shares. Taking into account our shareholder returns, other uses of cash, and our prudent financial policy, we believe our optimal net debt level is between £7 and £9 billion. I'll now hand you back to Gavin to take you through our strategy and outlook.
Thank you, Tony, and good morning, and welcome to the Grange. So pleased that you got the invitation and came here and didn't go to BT Centre, which is one of the things we were concerned about. Over the next half an hour or so, I'm going to spend my time talking about how we're going to evolve our strategy over the next few years. I'm going to focus on three things in particular: our strengths and where we see our source of competitive advantage, where we see the growth opportunities, and ultimately how we're going to create value across the business. But before I do that, I thought it would be worth just taking stock for a moment and look at how the business has developed over the last 3 years since we did the last Capital Markets Day. And the business has changed quite dramatically. There's a significant change to the revenue. We were declining at 3% a year 3 years ago. It's now a growing business. We've taken over $3 billion out of costs across the business as a whole, and this is we've used this to fund investments across the whole of the group. We've brought fiber to another 10 million homes, taking the total to 25 million in terms of the coverage across the UK. We've successfully launched BT Sport, which now has over 5 million customers across the UK. And of course, we've got back into mobile, initially behind the successful launch of BT Mobile, but now with the acquisition of EE, we've got a very strong business that really positions us extremely well for the future. So net-net, we've got a business that's generating 23% more free cash flow than it was 3 years ago. The theme of today, and indeed the focus of our strategy, is about seizing the opportunity of convergence. You know, we see this as the most important way of driving long-term, sustainable, profitable revenue growth, which is the goal of the business. We feel we've got a fantastic position to create the UK's leading converged operator. That's not just about the network, it's about the people, and it's about using customer experience to create competitive advantage. There will be further cost transformation, as Tony outlined, and we'll touch on that more through the day. And it's that cost transformation that will fund the dividend growth that we've talked about. It'll reduce our debt, It'll ensure that the pension is fully funded, but ultimately it will also create the room to invest to continue to grow over the next few years. Now, this is the strategy we've been following for the last few years. I'm sure it's etched on your mind, and this is one we've talked about at every set of results. In many ways, it's served us very well. It's been based on three tenets, customer experience or customer service, cost transformation and investing for growth, and we'll talk more about those in a minute. But in terms of those growth areas, I think we've made a significant amount of progress. Fibre, which is the first of those, as I said, now covers 25 million premises across the UK. That's 85% of the UK, or 90% if the Virgin footprint is included, can get access to superfast broadband now. There are 5.9 million homes and businesses connected to our network. That's a take-up of 23%, and importantly, it's take-up across the board with other CPs apart from our own downstream businesses, other CPs picking up around 50% of the net adds in a typical quarter now. TV and content has changed dramatically and been a big success. So I said 5 million homes taking BT Sport, initially behind the Premier League, and in the last 12 months we've kicked on with the launch of BT Sport Europe and BT Sport Ultra HD, which was of course the first Ultra HD content in the UK. And of course, the platform itself has really grown significantly. So in the last year, the customer base is up 28% to over 1.5 million. There's real momentum there. On mobility, as I said, BT Mobile launched just over a year ago, now has 400,000 customers and is proving to be very popular. But we've got this exciting business now with the acquisition of EE, and I think that allows us to truly take advantage of the opportunities around convergence, and we'll spend more time talking about that. In the business markets, there have been headwinds, but you could see in Tony's presentation, we're beginning to address them. There's real momentum here in the UK, I think, here. It's all about IP and the transition to an all-IP set of products and services, and that's really taking off, as you can see from these numbers. And of course, fibre, important to business customers as well. And then globally, our global services businesses has had headwinds, but we're seeing real progress there as well. Things like the security practice we've got with revenues up 24% year on year, real momentum in that part of the business. And geographically, we've seen our high growth regions continue to grow with, for example, growth in EMEA up 12% year on year. So I think net-net, the investments we've been laying down that we've been talking to you about every quarter have really begun to work for us. Now, as with the acquisition of EE, we wanted to take a moment to look at our structure to make sure it was serving customers in the way we felt was most effective, and so we moved some things around. So bear with me over the shot because these next three slides can be a little confusing. This is what the business looked like with the integration of EE to start with. On the 29th of January. Of course, EE was a completely formed business serving all customer segments, and it had its own technology unit. So we've moved some things around, particularly these. I'll let you take a moment just to consider them. And that is the structure of the business moving forward. Okay? So a technology and services operation that is supporting the whole of the business, that includes the mobility technology unit from EE. Then if you move upwards, two consumer-facing units, the EE consumer business and BT consumer. A new B2B unit in the UK that includes the old BT business, includes GS corporate from the UK and EE's B2B business, and also the public sector's customers that were part of GS going forward. So it's a beefed up business with about 5 billion revenues servicing domestic customers here in the UK, business and public sector. A more focused global services revenue, still with 5 billion revenues, so pretty significant, but really focused now on multinational companies operating across several countries and regions and indeed the world. BT Wholesale and Ventures includes the traditional wholesale business we've had. We've added in the MVNO business from EE, and we've pulled together the ventures that we've had across BT into one unit so that they can serve all customers across the group and be more entrepreneurial in how they do that. And then Openreach, which has remained exactly the same. So I'm going to talk now about how we're going to evolve the strategy. But before I go into that, I want to talk about some of the themes that we're trying to address in the update of the strategy today. And these are the four things I'm going to talk about. So first of all, convergence. So this is in many ways a bit of a cliche. It's been around for probably 20 years, but you know, it continues to gather pace and it continues to be one of the critical driving factors in the markets we operate in, be those consumer markets or B2B markets. It is, if you look here on this example, you know, the boundaries between fixed, broadband, mobile and TV are beginning to blur. Customers want solutions that combine combinations of these, be those quad play type solutions or triple play or dual play solutions. Clearly, the fixed to mobile part of that is in its infancy, and we're well placed to take advantage of that. TV and broadband is more established. We would argue that the TV element of this is being ill-served by the market, where Sky continue to have a dominant position with over 75% market share, and more restrictions in terms of the switching rules so that they can retain more customers. It's not a seamless switching mechanism as it is in the broadband market, and that is something that will need to be addressed if this market is going to be truly converged and truly a level playing field. But I think as we become a fully converged service provider going forward, it's pretty obvious that we've got a strong place to really operate here with a lot of upside. I mean, if you look at quad play penetration here on the right-hand side, the UK is underdeveloped versus almost every market in Europe, and that's one of the areas we see as a real growth opportunity. The second market trend is around data. So the growth of data is exponential. Very easy thing to say. Howard will talk more about later of our ability to deliver that at the right price, but just looking at this chart, you can see the growth rates that we're having to cope with across the business. And this is a high-quality problem to have. People wanting to use more and more of your product, it's got to be a good thing. But the key is being able to deliver it in a way that provides good value and a seamless service to customers at the right price. But just to characterize it, within 3 years' time, we will need to be able to convey three times the data across our network that we conveyed last year. It's that sort of growth rate that we're looking to address. We think we're well placed to take advantage of this and really help customers here, and that's because we have the best network in the UK. If you combine the reach and scale of our fibre network together with what we've got now with 4G through EE, that combination means that we've got a fantastic opportunity here to address, and this is going to be a theme we come back to later. One of the things people are using this the data consumption is coming from is using the cloud to deliver their services to their end customers. Now this is a trend that is affecting all B2B customers. We talk about public sector here, businesses is exactly the same. It can be a very difficult transition. You need a trusted partner to do that, but ultimately we're seeing more and more businesses making that transition, and indeed more and more public sector customers to do that. That is why we've reorganized the business to serve customers through the business and public sector unit itself. But it's also something that we'll talk more about with in GS in particular, and how we're addressing global customers' needs through our cloud-to-cloud strategy. And that's something Lewis will talk about later. Which brings me on to trend four, which is around globalization and the trend that we've seen from a number of years that many multinationals are looking to provide their operations with global solutions where we can respond to their needs and where they're moving their operations around the world. Digital transformation is very much part of this theme. Cost transformation is very much part of this theme as well. So they are It is being used as a way of transforming the way they're operating the business. But importantly, the network itself is fundamental to it. And that is where we believe we've got a real strength. So we have the global reach across that network. We have the security expertise. As I mentioned earlier, our security practice is growing 24% year after year. We've got a strong portfolio, ability to service around the clock, strength in consulting. All these things are critical, and it's allowing us to win more and more business from multinationals, as Tony mentioned in his presentation earlier. So, moving on to how we are evolving the strategy, and the emphasis is on evolving, because much of the strategy is working for us. Fundamentally, it's all about sustainable, profitable revenue growth. That's the goal that we're focused on. It's about the relationships we have with our customers. How can we strengthen those? How can we broaden those? How can we increase our share of wallet our customers spend with us? The three building blocks of service, investment, and growth, service, investment, and cost transformation are still there. There's a tweak to the one on service, which I'll come into in a minute. Cost transformation remains fundamental, and we've got a section on it later, but there have been some concerns, I think, that we're running out of road on cost transformation. One of the things we want to assure you of today is there's still plenty to go for, and we'll outline how we're going to get that $1 billion that Tony talked about earlier out over the next couple of years. In terms of that service and the evolution to customer experience, this is an important one. Basics of service are absolutely critical, but increasingly we're learning that service itself alone is not enough to really drive profitable revenue growth. You've got to create an outstanding customer experience that involves excelling at a number of other factors, and I'll talk more about that now. First of all, expectations arising from customers. It's an obvious thing to say, but the sort of products we offer our customers are becoming more and more integrated in the way they live their lives and they run their businesses and the way we educate and govern. And it's what we're seeing is increasingly that price alone is not the answer. Increasingly things like the quality of the service, the reliability of the service, these are factors that are influencing the choice that customers are made. So to address that, we've looked at investing in three areas: people, the networks themselves, and products. If I look at, to start with, on people, what we're seeing is customers want calls answered in the UK. And this is something we've seen changing over the last few years. We've made a number of announcements around it. But we are moving to move our contact centres and the calls themselves to be answered increasingly over the UK, out of the UK over the next year. So for EE, by March 2017, 100% of calls from EE customers will be answered in UK contact centres. The consumer business is starting from a lower base, but will get to 90% by this time next year. It's not just simply about rerouting the calls to the UK, it's about changing the experience when they're here. So we've looked at simplifying the way we serve customers, reducing the number of handoffs, training our advisors to be able to handle more questions and issues from customers as part of that training itself. And it's also about reducing the need to call in the first place. So for example, we've taken the propensity to call down 44% over the last 3 years, and that's an area we'll continue to focus on. It's about improving the digital capabilities of service. So, again, a trend we see is that more and more customers want to serve themselves over the internet, be that sales, as you can see on the top chart from our consumer business, now over 40% of sales are through online, or it can be through apps and services. This data here on the at the bottom is for EE, but it's true in our consumer business as well, and even in Openreach, where the My Engineer app is proving extremely popular. It's true in the consumer business, it's true in the business markets as well. What we're seeing is customers want to serve themselves, and we've got to invest in digital. And then around the products and network itself, ensuring that the products are more reliable, the more stable is part of our strategy. It includes focusing on workmanship and the quality of the engineering jobs themselves, reducing the number of missed appointments, for example, improving the repeat rates is an area we're focused on, and that's something that Clive will talk about later. It's also about looking at the products themselves and trying to ensure that customers migrate over onto to better products and those products improve over time. So if you look at the chart there, the fault rate on fiber has come down consistently over the last few years as we've begun to optimize the product. This is the thing we see with all products and services as they become more mature. But importantly, from a customer perspective, customers have a much better experience and are more likely to recommend if they are fiber customers. And it's not just a marginal amount, it's 20 percentage points. So again, it's key to ensuring we have happier, loyal, more loyal customers who are going to stay with us longer. I wanted just to touch on the brand situation because this is an area that there's been some discussion about. We want to follow a multi-brand strategy. It is a choice we're making, and it's a very simple one. We're able to serve more of the customer, more of the marketplace, get a higher consideration across the market if we have multiple brands. It may sound obvious, but it is quite a significant difference. You know, we can cover over 50% more of the market with a three-brand strategy than we can with a single-brand strategy. It just doesn't make sense trying to fold this into one brand, certainly at the moment. The brands need to really mark out their territory and remain disciplined about that. But I think we've demonstrated with BT and Plusnet over the last few years that we're able to do that and grow two businesses simultaneously and ensure that they don't overlap. And EE, we see, has a very distinctive footprint as well and an area that we think will add incrementally to our overall coverage of the market. So we will be following a multiple brand strategy going forward. I want to move on and talk about investment for growth and talk about how we're changing the areas that we're looking at going forward. And it starts with being a fully converged service provider. This is at the center of everything we do, which is why it's the center pillar. This is about creating a seamless network that covers the best of fixed, the best of mobile. It's about moving to an all IP network, a common single access platform that allows you to connect to it, be it through fixed, through copper, fiber, mobile. It's one platform that's able to serve all customers, be those consumers, businesses, public sector, right the way across the board. And this is a core that we've already built. So this is a theme that Howard is going to talk to in more detail later, but it is the single most important point of our convergence vision. It's this network that will allow us to deliver the products and services and the cost transformation that will give us competitive advantage. Second area is around the network itself, and we've touched on this earlier, but I think with the combination of BT and EE, we will have the best network in the UK. On 4G, as we announced last week, we will have geographical coverage of over 95%, up from the market-leading 60% today. That is on the back of the investments around the ESN network, and it will give us a true competitive advantage. And again, this is something that Mark will go into in more detail, because I think it is an area that will allow us to differentiate ourselves significantly. And Superfast, the plan to get to 95% of the UK by the end of 2017 is on track. We're part of that, and it's a government goal. It is our ambition to go further. There's no doubt about that, and it's one of the things we're talking to government about today. It's not just about Superfast, it's about Ultrafast. We've previously talked about 10 million Ultrafast homes by the end of 2020. We have an ambition to get to another 2 million, to make that 12 million, with an increasing percentage of that coming through FTTP, as we've learned more over the last couple of months about how we can deliver FTTP solutions to businesses and new development in a more cost-effective way. And that's something that Clyde is going to talk about. And then finally, just to give you a scale of the investment involved here, if you look at across Openreach and EE CapEx, that's going to be around 6 billion over the next 3 years. with continued investment into 2020 after that. The third area of differentiation comes in the content and applications and services that are carried over the network itself. This is about bundling, no question about that. Bundling in the consumer market. It's also bundling in the business market, particularly the SOHO and SME end of things. But it's also about investment in things like sport and content. And we will continue to do that going forward. Sport has been a huge success for us. We'll continue to be disciplined about the way we add rights and renew rights as part of that investment. But it has provided a point of differentiation, and that is absolutely critical. There are other elements of differentiation in different parts of our proposition. So security is an area that is of huge significance in the business market and public sector. We've got a really strong practice there that is growing. We'll continue to invest there. Investments in cloud is another area, unified communications. So it's not about investing across the board. It's about being really selective about where we can add applications and content and services to provide differentiation. These last two areas about where we focus from a geographical perspective. And there won't be any great surprise, I think, here. In the UK, it is our ambition to be market leader in every segment we serve. Consumer, business, public sector, wholesale, corporate. We have the strength of market position. We have the strength of network. We're prepared to make those investments. But outside of the UK, we have to be more selective. And our focus will be on multinationals, building on the strength that we've had over the last few years. It's a market that is very dynamic. We have a strong position. We're generating cash. And we have a strategy that is working in the cloud of cloud strategy that Lewis will articulate in more detail later. Now, as Tony mentioned earlier, there are regulatory headwinds. And there's no doubt those are increasing rather than decreasing at the moment. And these will be higher over the next 2 years. But we believe we can continue to grow the business in spite of those. And it's the investments we've been making over the last few years, the downstream parts of the business in particular, that give us that confidence. Now, so I'm clear, we support regulatory change where it improves customer experience, where it promotes fair competition. We're prepared to support. We recognize that's the part of the way the market works. Where it doesn't do that, where it doesn't allow a fair return for investors, we will challenge, and we make no apologies for that. That said, the investments we've been making have allowed us to offset the headwinds over the last few years. As I said, the headwinds are going to get greater, but we feel confident we will be able to address that. And it is worth just dwelling on this. I won't spend too long explaining it all, but the investments we've been making have benefited the whole of the UK. So this is, amongst other sources of data, it's Ofcom data is included in here, but if you look at fibre, and you look at coverage, you look at take-up, look at price, all of these dimensions and many others, the UK is at the top of the chart across Europe in any comparison. And I think it's something just worth dwelling on for a second. We are providing an infrastructure that is the fabric of the UK, not just for BT customers. And just in wrapping up, one other thing I wanted to talk about is how the sort of centre of gravity of the business will change over the next few years. So with the acquisition of EE, almost 60% of our revenues will be part of the downstream part, 60% of our EBITDA will be part of the downstream part of BT. So our dependency on Openreach for free cash flow and EBITDA going forwards becomes less. So the way to think of the business is the UK domestic business is going to be around 60% of that EBITDA. We're extremely well placed to take advantage of the digital transformation that is going on, be it in the consumer or the business space. We have a leading position on FMC, and we have a premium position in the marketplace. Openreach will continue to be a very attractive business, vertically integrated to de-risk any investment, but with an appropriate return that comes from being a regulated asset. And then we've got this very interesting international business, which once you look at it going forward, is growing. We're one of the market leaders in that business with the competitive advantages around using our network in particular and its ability to access cloud-based applications and services. And in many cases, others are retrenching from this market, so we do see plenty of growth there. So it is an interesting combination of assets to give you a diversified portfolio. So, in summing up, a couple of things. This is how we plan to drive sustainable revenue growth over the next few years. So our investments today have been fueling the growth, there's no question about that, and we'll continue to invest with the discipline we have over the last few years. Cost transformation remains absolutely key to the way we generate cash and fund investments going forward. Our products are the type of products our customers want. There will be multiple brands in terms of delivering those products and services through a branded experience. Our focus will be on increasing share of wallet, be that through RGUs or through spend. And customer experience will increasingly be part of the way we drive revenue growth. Our network, we believe, is second to none. Largest superfast network with the best 4G network, and we intend to be first with 5G. Got a growing business overseas with strength in security, cloud, and IP. And we're operating in markets that can grow. So it is quite a potent combination. That is why we have the confidence to guide not just for this year, but 2 years, as Tony said. And I won't go over this again. But just to remind you, that comes with a minimum growth in the dividend of at least 10% this year and next year, and growth in revenue in both years. So, in summarizing, today is about seizing the opportunity around convergence, and we see that as the real source of our competitive advantage. It is the thing that's going to allow us to drive sustainable, profitable revenue growth over the next few years. We will be the leading converged operator in the UK. We'll have the best network. We've got the people who really understand it. And we'll ensure that the customer experience through that is a source of competitive advantage. Cost transformation, I can't say it enough, will continue to be part of the formula. And we'll use that to help fund our investments for growth. Thank you very much. And we will open for questions. Right. I'm going to use the normal rules. I'm going right to left and try and keep it to one question because there are plenty of times to ask questions today. I think this is a 30-minute spin, so we will start over there with Robert.
Thank you very much. I arrived in late. My question, I guess, if there's one, is on the guidance. Very impressive to have given. I look at the sector sometimes. And could you give a bit more clarity? Three of you, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's probably not much impact in that. And what have you sort of broadly assumed for? Is it just a known regulatory headwind that you clarified that there are quite a few of them? And is it sort of normal pricing inflation like you just that type of stuff? But that was just one question.
Great questions there, Robert. But I'll let Tony chip in a moment, but maybe I'll just say a couple of opening comments. I think we have demonstrated over a number of years an ability to deliver against an outlook, but be able to cope with changes in the market, changes in the competitive situation, and at times bringing forward investment where we saw a business case and a demand to do that. And that is, I guess, the way we look at things. That's the mentality we look at. There's always things going on in our market. Ultimately, there'll be things that come along that we can't even see today. It is that dynamic. But if we focus on where we can see the value, if we focus on where we see our customers' needs, and we really focus on execution in particular, we're very confident that we can deliver over the next couple of years. In terms of the moving parts, Tony, I don't know whether you want to comment on anything specifically there.
Robert, you probably want to look at my file here, which has got all the detailed assumptions. Unfortunately, you won't be given access to it. I think the key point, though, is when we put a plan together, we have a high, you know, we put in a degree of contingency. We have detailed assumptions that underpinning that. And while I'm not going to say to you the number relating to the project lightning is X or Y, all the factors that you highlighted, we've got an assumption associated with it. We've got a degree of confidence associated with the level of contingency we've got, and that's why we're willing to put an outlook number there. And hopefully you've seen historically over the last 7 years, if we put an outlook and we put guidance numbers out there, we'll deliver on those. I think it's just worth also highlighting, because there was a little bit of confusion in some of the reports that came out this morning in relation to what does this guidance actually mean in relation to the free cash flow number compared to what was in there previously on your consensus. The first piece is I think your consensus numbers were out because there's a timing in relation to tax. And so effectively, your consensus numbers have got to be up by around about $200 million for the tax payment profile. So the 3.3 that you had in there will become 3.5. We're saying that our numbers will be 3.6 billion, but that 3.6 billion includes £100 million of integration capital expenditure. This is the integration of the EE, and it's incorporated within the 550, and it's simple accounting rules which say we're going to take that number above the line rather than below the line. So in real terms, it's our 3.6 on a like-for-like basis becomes 3.7 compared to a consensus of 3.5, and that's where we get to the upgrade situation.
Thank you, Tony. I even followed that. Simon.
I wondered if I could ask you to touch on the little bit of regulatory positioning you placed there regarding the situations where you might challenge things that are coming your way from Ofcom that you don't feel are good for customers, good for investment. The particular focus, I guess, would be dark fibre ruling under the BCMR, whether or not there's still time to challenge that, and if so, when that time would expire, and whether it qualifies. And the other one would be anything that might come out in due course regarding the control governance arrangements around Openreach, whether there are scenarios you can envisage there which sure. You know, you might not be happy with.
Look, we recognise regulation is appropriate where there is an economic bottleneck. We've never tried to defend that in a way. We've always supported the importance of doing that for the benefit of the country as a whole. And indeed, the UK is the most regulated market when it comes to that local loop. It is right on the extreme of the spectrum of regulatory solutions. My point in general is to make sure that there is a level playing field in a converged world. It is ridiculous that there are different switching regimes and switching rules between the different products in the market, and it isn't just seamless, irrespective of where you've started from. And that is something that needs to be addressed. In my view, when one player has a 75% market share in pay TV, while in any of the other markets that we talked about, nobody has more than 40, that seems a situation that needs to be addressed at some point as well. So that was why I was making the point. Regarding the specifics of dark fibre, we don't think dark fibre regulation is well conceived. We think over time will lead to a consolidation of the market that will make all the smaller players, many of whom are providing innovative solutions tailored for their customers on the Openreach platform today, they will find it harder and harder to compete if dark fibre becomes the dominant form of access in the way that the LLU came in the consumer market. And you could see the consolidation happening within consumer. So we are considering our choices at the moment about whether or not we would like to challenge it. Interestingly, all the infrastructure providers were critical of this when the Ofcom ruling came out. There are many others who are, I think, considering that position as well. And when we've made a decision, we've got a bit of time yet before we decide on what to do, we'll tell you about it. Very good. Now, my eyesight isn't as good at the back there because it's a bit dark. Yes.
Yeah, good morning. It's Jerry Gellis.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I've got a question on costs, please. To give us some perspective on your guidance for gross cost savings, could you tell us how much gross cost reduction was achieved last year and the year before? And perhaps allied to that, perhaps you could just sort of highlight why, given the visibility that you say you've got on cost reduction, you weren't tempted to perhaps quantify an EBITDA target or perhaps a range for the 17-18 year. Thank you.
Joan, I know you'd be desperate to answer that one, so I'll let you have it.
Sure. So there's two component parts in here. The trend in relation to cost, gross cost transformation savings the last 2 or 3 years compared to moving forward is not materially different. And I think we'll go into more detail after the cost transformation session. And if we need further detail, I suggest you have a follow-up on there. In relation to the EBITDA target, we felt you had a cash number in there, and the cash number was pretty specific. The EBITDA follows through the cash because there's not going to be material movement from working capital. So it's not a question in relation to confidence, more a question of saying, here's a cash number, it'll follow through from that.
Very good. Okay, Steve.
Hi there, Steve Mark of Marathon. I'm afraid I'm going to stick on regulation, but I'll try and ask a slightly more precise question. The 17-18 guidance, is that baking in broadly the current Ofcom proposals on cost allocation review? Should we assume that you've put in the full $160 million for that, give or take? And I guess allied to that, can you help us understand what you think the return on capital in the Open Reach Access division is at the moment against your load costs? Because it's pretty hard to work out looking at your regulatory financials. Thank you.
I think on the latter, we can probably, Damien and the team can talk to you through that detail. In relation to the former, we've got our estimate of what that number should be. It takes into account Ofcom's views. It takes into account what we think needs to change associated with that. We will not have, in my view, an exposure associated with what will turn out in relation to our numbers.
Very good. Nick.
Thanks so much. I was going to ask about leverage, but since we've got Mike Rake on the stage, I thought I'd ask a different question. So the BT Group has taken a very strong pro-EU stance. I'm just interested what you think the financial consequences of Brexit would be. Would you no longer be able to operate in the European Union? Would you have to sell BT Italia? Are you somewhat conflicted because under the directive of 2002, the European Commission is the arbiter, ultimately, of whether BT is broken up?
Yeah. How long have you got? Look, the principle of this, we think, is very clear, and the board is very clear. I think very strongly that companies today have a responsibility to speak out on those issues that they think are important for their business and for their employees and their stakeholders. And that is what we've done. In fact, under the Companies Act, you're required to discuss and explain events and issues that could impact on your investment decisions. For us, to be honest, I think the major impact is indirect. We want to see a healthy economy in the United Kingdom. We want to see investment in this country continue. We want to see people able to take up our products. We want to see us engaged in a global world effectively from within a market of 500 million people. So I would say in our business here, it's the indirect impact of what 95% of economists and other substantial sources say will have a significantly negative impact on our economy over time. I think then it just makes our life more complex in dealing in the European Union, dealing with telecoms where we've seen huge advances, roaming and other issues, and trying to create in a complex telecommunications world the beginning for the level playing field that we can use effectively. And also I think our influence around the world will diminish. So, in short, we think this is really important. We think we have an obligation. We're not telling people how to vote. People have the right to vote to leave. But what the Out campaign, of course, has not done is admit, at least some of them have admitted, the significant economic and financial cost of leaving.
Is there any quid pro quo with the Commission on separation?
No, there's absolutely no connection at all between, you know, our position in, with the government or with the Commission in relation to this matter. Those are purely factual matters. Indeed, you know, we were speaking out and I was speaking out when some members of the Cabinet were saying we shouldn't speak out. We've always just felt we have to do the right thing.
Very good. Guy?
Thanks. It's Guy Fay from Macquarie, just for those listening in. Quick question. In your notes to your report, you talk about an expectation for ongoing continued declines in mobile pricing. Given with EE now you're already losing customers, admittedly mostly prepaid, but you are losing customers, and with the competition that you talk about in your notes as well, the market's getting tougher, potentially implies that you might actually lose more mobile customers going forward with new entrants. I'm just want to understand if you can explain how or what you see is actually the drivers of growth in particular within the mobile business, given those two dynamics are effectively headwinds. Thank you.
Well, it is our responsibility to give a balanced view of the risks that we face as a business, which is what we've articulated there. And with the with roaming across Europe becoming standard over the next year, that will provide some headwind, particularly in terms of the monthly ARPUs that we're able to generate from customers. And that's one of the things we've made the point of. Against that, data consumption is going up. We have to find ways of monetizing that so that it's accretive from a monthly ARPU basis. But that's a high-quality problem to have to solve. Having a service that people want to use more and more of, where you have, in our case, we have the best network that is geared for 4G more than anybody else. That's where we see the sources of growth. And on top of that, if you layer on the opportunities that come from convergence and driving penetration of mobile, particularly in the business market where EE was under-penetrated and we have the reach through the BT customer base, we see plenty of opportunity to move the top line from mobile-related services going forward.
Very good. Okay. Just to add to that, we've also got the synergies that will come through on the revenue side as a result of the integration, both right. In the consumer and the business space.
Yeah. I'll go Morrison and Sunil. If we can have a mic down here, please.
Yeah, hi, it's Ian Morrison, Barclays. So you say you're the leading converged operator in the UK post-EE. It seems like Hutch O2's failing. Maybe your key competitors don't seem as well positioned in a converged world that you talk about, and maybe not as well invested as yourselves, given what they've been spending in the past years. EU and Ofcom are talking about more pro-investment, I mean, competition rather than just pure competition. You talk about growing your share of wallet, and you've spoken about taking share in enterprise at the EU. But curious your thoughts on consumer. Do you see yourselves and your growth taking more market share of consumers, retail market share, or just growing more wallets from your own customers?
Well, I think there is the scope to grow market share in the consumer markets, both behind the EE brand, behind the BT brand, and behind PlusNet. And I think we've demonstrated with broadband over the last few years, Morris, that we've been able to do that. I think fundamentally we see RGU growth behind convergence, be that quad play or triple play, as being the engine rather than necessarily putting it all through incremental customers. Be it on fixed to mobile, where the market is very underdeveloped versus many of our European peers, or with triple play, conventional triple play, where our TV attachment rate is still relatively low in spite of the growth rates over the last few years, there's plenty of upside to go for. And what we know is that the more products and services customers take from you, provided they see that the quality of products and the reliability of product and the value of the products, they are more loyal and they have more value from a net present value perspective. So it is, you know, it's a trend that's working in our direction, and we see plenty of growth there going forward. Sunil.
Thank you. Good morning, Sunil from Bank of America. Earlier this year, Ofcom at the time of the strategic review talked around working on proposals to put in front of the Commission around greater open reach independence, but obviously leaving the door open for negotiations, discussions with BT. You made various comments around ambitions for open reach, 6 billion CapEx plus V, obviously over the next 3 years, 12 million, up to 12 million by 2020. How much of that is dependent on a voluntary settlement with Ofcom, and what are, if any, red lines in your discussions with them, and how does it impact those ambitions that you spelled out this morning?
Well, I'm not going to go into graphic detail of our discussions with Ofcom today. The discussions are ongoing, and I think we remain optimistic that we can find a voluntary agreement between us that ensures that the UK gets the sort of investment that we all believe it needs over the next few years to stay at the top of the charts when it comes to internet economies around the world, and one that ensures that ultimately shareholders of BT can get a fair return for the sort of investments they've made. So we've considered the conclusions that have come out of the DCR. We're ready and indeed have made proposals to Ofcom around strengthening the governance around Openreach, ensuring that the decision-making processes around how we allocate capital are clearer, being prepared to step up to higher service expectations, which are within Ofcom's gift today, of course, and indeed we've delivered over the last 2 years on the service levels that have been expected of us through Openreach. But we're ready to step up to that strengthened governance because we're very confident that what we're doing is the right solution for the country as a whole, and it's a good solution for BT shareholders at the same time. So I'm not going to go into all the details, and I'm not going to negotiate publicly via today's meeting. But I think there is the scope to move forward in a way that gets a fast solution that will allow us all to be to move on and get on with the investments that clearly we want to do. Do you want to add anything, Mike?
No, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think we're absolutely motivated by what's the right thing for the country, you know, and that's where we continue to try and draw the lines, where there's a cost of balance effectiveness to improve, if you will, governance and transparency of governance. I think the only thing I'd add is, you know, you hear a lot of noise out there, and this has become a bit of a political issue, and a little bit that's because it's a great opportunity for us, because people are just desperate. The demand exponentially, Gavin talks about the demand for more speed right now, which for us motivates us anyhow, because it's necessary for the country to be competitive, and we have a huge business opportunity. But there's a lot of noise out there, you know, of real nonsense. So we're focused on trying to just keep it to the facts, keep it to the decisions that should be made that are right for the country and allow us, as we said earlier, to invest properly to get a return and to deliver the kind of broadband that makes this country even more competitive than it is.
Very good. We'll go Nick, then John, then Andy.
Everyone, it's Nick Lyle from Salt Gems. Actually, very... On the same topic, rather, as Sunil's question, but you talked in the presentation specifically about talks on functional separation. Ofcom was very set, it seemed, on legal separation at the time of the DCR. So can we conclude today that you've actually at least reached some common ground on functional separation? And you may have just answered about not giving more detail, Gavin, to be fair, but would it be possible to tell us what sorts of things would be acceptable in terms of independence for the Openreach board for you as well?
Just around the definitions, legal incorporation can be part of functional separation in itself. It doesn't. It's not related to structural separation per se. So, as I say, I don't want to go into a lot of detail. It would be inappropriate for me to sort of try and negotiate through you guys to Ofcom. We believe there is a way forward on functional separation that gives confidence around transparency. It gives confidence around how the decision-making process is enacted, but at the same time ensures that the fiduciary responsibilities of the BT board are respected,
and acknowledged, and ultimately, as the owner of Openreach, we need to make sure that we can live up to that expectation and those responsibilities. It's also worth noting that incorporation per se does not replace regulation, whether it's incorporated or not. Indeed, whether it's structurally separated or not, Openreach is governed by regulation, and the outcomes that the Openreach business will deliver will be set by regulations that come out of the EU and are implemented in the UK. Incorporation per se doesn't change that one way or another. And the risks are that it just adds additional cost into the business for no net benefit. John.
Thank you. It's John Corridis from Haitong Securities. You've told us that you'll be spending about 400 million capex from the ESN contract. What can you tell us to help us size up the opportunity here? Revenue, returns, payback, anything. If you could throw us a bone on this one, that would be really good, please.
John, do you want to...
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the best way of putting this is we put a bid together, and when that bid was identified, it gave us a return based on that investment. But what it does also do is it gives us a return in relation to the reach and the quality of the network that we have as a result of undertaking that activity that will help us in terms of generating incremental revenues and cash flows from the additional business that we will get on top. And we've outlined the fact that we're going to put in £300 million this coming year. We've also said that the following year it'll be £100 million. That's where you get your £400 million from. I think it'd be fair to say, John, that the payback on this will be within the contract duration period, and the profile will be very similar to any type of network investment. But the bottom there is the additional flows we'll get from incremental business that will be driven by improving the quality of the network. I can't give you and won't give you an exact number on what that payback period is. But it's a double whammy in terms of the positive.
Sorry, have you actually said what the duration of the contract is?
Mark, have we made that public?
We made it public. Thank you.
Andrew. And then Will, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. I think your kind of first or second slide kind of was the starkest thing versus the last capital markets, but you're growing now and you're forecasting growth for the next 2 years. So I just wanted to ask a question around how you think about the sustainability of growth. You've been talking for the last kind of year about trying to find a better balance between volume and pricing to give you better visibility and more sustainability. I just wondered if you could talk about how far along that transition you are, how much confidence and visibility that gives you on 3 to 5 year growth, and how important, you know, regulation is on that transition.
How many questions is that? We are focused on growing the top line of the business. It's not just any growth. It has to be profitable, and we've been very clear about that. So we have reshaped the revenue over the last couple of years to make it increasingly network oriented, which is really where our core business is. To grow over the long term, we need all parts or the majority of the units to be growing. We can't be dependent on one or two, and you've seen that coming through in these numbers. You know, a number of the units are beginning to show top line growth, not just the consumer unit, and that's it. That's critical. The mix, we want to be ultimately more dependent on share of wallet and RGU growth than price. Where we take price, we want to be improving value for customers at the same time, and the pricing changes we announced in the consumer business last week are an example of that. Higher speeds, better repair in terms of faster service, UK contact centres, which is what customers want. So it's better value as opposed to simply price. So I think you can see it in the consumer business already. The RGU story is very much driving the business, and that is a very sustainable one. The centre of gravity of the business is changing. We've showed it in the pie charts earlier. Openreach remains absolutely core to our business. It is what all the downstream businesses in the UK are built on. We have a vested interest in making sure that that is a properly invested network with high quality service on a national basis. But it is a regulated asset, and it is important that we reduce our dependency over time on that, because we believe our downstream businesses can flourish in a competitive market. I think we've been able to show that over the last few years. They are winning, and that's why both business and consumer are growing. And that's what we need over the long term. So the way I look at the group is, you know, we've got the downstream units in the UK, EE, BT, business, public sector, and consumer, that are able to really address the digital, the digitization of the market, and be well placed to take advantage of that, fixed to mobile convergence. Openreach becomes increasingly a very attractive, regulated business, making very predictable but regulated returns, and will continue to make sure it is properly invested. And then we've got this very interesting global services business that is growing now in its more focused orientation. It's winning more new business and growth business, and it is able to exploit the trends around cloud, around security, and around network reach, where we've got true competitive advantage. And I think that's quite a nice combination for investors. Not completely dependent on the UK, a bit of an international flavour to it, but really exploiting the strength of market position we've got in the UK in unregulated markets. Very good. Will.
Hi, it's Will Draver at Mirabeau. You talked a bit about differentiated content as one of your five drivers of growth, and it's sort of peppered through the slides as one of the differentiators for you. You're obviously quite pleased with the way it's gone so far. You're getting some critical mass with 2 million peak viewers, etc. And you've now got an EE customer base and a big 4G network to distribute more content over. I'm just wondering where you're going with content. Are you happy with what you have, or are you encouraged to push harder on content? And if so, in what kind of direction you might go? Thank you.
Well, this is something we will touch on later in John's presentation in particular. Content as a form of differentiation has worked for us. We've really done that mainly in sport, I think the results have been pretty good. If you look, it's less than 3 years since we launched, and I think we've got a very credible number two player in the market, and we're happy with that. We will be disciplined about how we invest, continue to be disciplined in how we invest going forward. So we, you know, market leadership at any cost is not a strategy we will follow in sport per se. But we must make sure that it is a compelling offer for customers, and we've got the ability to make those sorts of investments. Outside of sport, general entertainment is very important. It's always worth remembering that at least half of the UK are not vaguely interested in sport at all. It seems hard to believe. It's important that we do not disappoint those customers because they see us as sport obsessed. Now, we've got, I think, a very good offering at the moment. We would like access to Sky's content in general entertainment film. We've got Sky Movies today. We'd like the Sky basic channels. And that's something that I think is missing at the moment. But we will look at other general entertainment opportunities to ensure that it's a compelling offer going forward. It's not simply a sport one. Stephen.
Yeah, thank you. Stephen Howard at HSBC. I've got a question on your enhanced fibre to the premise plans that you've unveiled today. Now, I mean, given the really quite impressive upgradability of hybrid fibre copper platforms, and in your release you mentioned a new technology, XG Fast, capable of perhaps doing 5 gigabits a second, what I'd like to understand a bit better is the economic case for going the whole hog, you know, beyond G.Fast, etc., and upgrading to fibre to the premise.
What are the incremental revenues you can drive from FTTP as opposed to G.fast, or to put it another way, what are the applications that require FTTP? Thanks.
We've always believed it's going to be a mixed technology solution that is the right solution for the UK. FTTC and upgrades to FTTC will be, I think, the majority of that. But what we've learnt with new techniques and new approaches over the last few months is that we can deliver FTTP at a much more cost-effective price point than we had a few years ago. So I'm not going to steal Clive's story, because he spends a bit of time talking about this later, but there is a role for it to play in the business markets, for example, in high streets, which have been some of the not spots that we've got at this point, in business parks, and in terms of where it sits in the portfolio, somewhere between the business connectivity provided by Ethernet and FTTC, there exists a point, I think, in the business market for an FTTP product. I think one of the other usage cases is housing developments. If we're in at the right point, it is just as easy and just as cost-effective to put a fiber line in there as a copper line. And there's no question about it. We've got about 250,000 fiber lines today. The fault rate with them is significantly lower. So like for like, you'd always put fiber in. We've talked about this in today's press release. Any development over 100 properties will put fiber in for free. And there are different solutions for developments less than that where there's a co-funding solution. So it isn't a blanket change of approach here. It is recognizing that actually you can do more fiber to the premise cost effectively, and if you can, you may as well do it. We'll come on to it later. Very good. Yes. And then I'll take one more because I'm overrunning.
Yeah, hi, it's Pearl Tang from UBS. Just really have a question about investment in content. So are you making a satisfactory return, and how do you measure it? So I suppose the question is less about Premier League, because clearly we've seen benefits in terms of reduced line loss, but I suppose it's a reference in terms of the investment in Champions League.
Well, I think you've in some ways you've answered your own question there. We see content as a differentiator, not a standalone business per se. We see its impact in terms of reducing line loss, ensuring that we continue to build our broadband and indeed our fiber customer base. It has direct revenues both in the consumer market where you can take the channel on satellite if you don't want to take our fiber. And indeed you pay now £5 a month if you don't want to be a BT TV customer. So there are direct revenues as well. There's advertising, there's sponsorship. Pubs and clubs, we have the most extensive reach of sport in pubs and clubs in the UK, and that is providing another revenue stream as well. So there are multiple ways of monetizing the investment. We're happy that we can see its impact on the consumer P&L. So we saw it with the first investment in Premier League. We bounced back after the investment year to be at to be generating profits that were higher than the base period. This year, the consumer EBITDA is marginally up year on year, we would expect going forward to roll through subsequently. So we are confident that it is generating the sort of returns that we want on the consumer business. And indeed, there are other ways to exploit and use the content now that we've got the customer base as well. So, in a nutshell, we know where it brings the value, and we don't lose our head when it comes to going after it in auction. I'm going to take one more, and then we're going to take a break. I do promise this afternoon, or is it this afternoon, next week? Yes.
It's Paul Marsh from Berenberg. I just wanted to ask about dark fiber and DPA. Have you had any material interest from competitors so far in those ideas, or is it just too early of competitors waiting to see the detail? And in the medium term, don't you really have to make those offers successful given the emphasis that Ofcom put on DPA in particular in the communications market review, which seemed to me an effort on Ofcom's part to deflect from the torrent of criticism that was going to come when they announced that they weren't going to push in the communications market review for an open reach split?
Well, if you talk about DPA, DPA is something we made available on a voluntary basis, I think 5 years ago now. There are a handful of uses of it today. We haven't been bowled over by demand. And I think when you look at why that is, some people say, oh, well, it's not usable and, you know, it takes too long to get access to the records. You know, if that's the case, and some people feel that way, we are addressing that. We're making the records available quicker. We're providing a digital map of everything. So the sort of serviceability of it is already being addressed. I think it is for different reasons it hasn't been taken up. I think it is because there is a very compelling wholesale fibre offer available that means that you can invest in your own fibre to the premise solution or your own infrastructure solution using ducts and poles, but it does not price in well against what is the one of the best wholesale prices in Europe for fibre. And interestingly, Sky said in their own results last week that they felt that using Openreach was probably the right way forward for them, and that ducts and poles access was not going to be a priority. And so I'm not going to put ourselves in the situation where we're judged to have inhibited it in any way. We'll make it available. Ofcom have said it's at the right price point when it's benchmarked against European comparators. We'll make it more serviceable. We'll provide the digital map to it. But if people don't take it up, they don't take it up. It may be because there are alternatives that are better for them, and that's certainly our belief. Oh, no, apparently there's 4 more minutes, so we can keep going. Yes. James.
Yes, thank you. James Schatz from New Street Research. I haven't had a question yet on your cash return policy. So just wondering if I could ask for some kind of more thinking around the dividend guidance. The greater than or equal to 10% is slightly more cautious than the 10 to 15% range you've had in the past, yet you seem to be more confident about the growth outlook. Arguably, the £7 to £9 billion leverage target you've given is looks low to me for a business that's growing. How much scope is there to go above 10%? Could we see a one-off cash return? Interesting to get your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Okay. We've been on 10 to 15% for the last few years. You know, that should be judged against the FTSE that's been at 5% revenue growth. And while we've had a wee bit of catching up to do over the last few years, we're at a payout ratio now that is, you know, it's certainly it's not high versus the sector, but it is high versus the rest of the FTSE. And we should keep that in mind. We have to balance the uses of our cash across a number of factors. We need to keep the network properly invested in. We want to ensure that the debt is paid down. We've taken on a load more debt with the acquisition of EE. We're now at $9 billion. We want to bring that down over the next few years. We want to ensure that we pay a good dividend, a consistent dividend. We couldn't continue at 10 to 15% indefinitely. So we wanted to signal we have the confidence for at least 10 over the next couple of years. But it will need to normalize if you look into the long-term future, and that's what we were trying to signify. And we should never forget that we have a pension that we need to ensure is properly funded going forwards. And you know, one of the reasons we've given 2 years and not beyond is that there is a valuation due in a couple of years' time, and we want to maintain flexibility going forward.
Just worth adding one point, Gavin. If you look at where your consensus numbers are in terms of the dividend 2 years out, you're at around about 11 points. This is, you know, pretty consistent with that number.
And I think, too, this is exactly an important time for all the reasons that Gavin gave for BT in the next 2 years. To be conservative but clear that that's the minimum with all the other investment, pension and other issues we face as we bring EE in. But I think it is a time, given the volatility we see in the markets, actually notwithstanding the very cheap finance we're able to get, to be conservative on debt and to be conservative on the balance sheet. Because I think, you know, we're all aware that life is a bit volatile at the moment. So I think the board would feel very strongly that we need to remain a level of conservatism here.
That's Paul, all right. Very good. Well, you will be our last question, Paul.
Thank you very much. It's Paul Sidney, Credit Suisse. Your operational metrics, again, look strong in the quarter. I was just really returning to Project Lightning. Are you seeing any impact so far operationally? And is that influencing your FTTP strategy, looking at what VMed's doing? Thank you.
I think it's early days for Lightning. Certainly what I've read is the Virgin did about 250,000 homes passed last year. I think the plan is to do over 500 this year. It's a mixture of FTTP and coax they're putting down, depending on where they are. You know, we're seeing some impact, not an awful lot, I would say, overall. I'm not going to quantify it. I think it's patchy, depends on the area. You know, it's a bullish business case. I mean, they've made it clear that I think it's 40% take-up is what's needed to make the thing pay. We don't see that sort of impact anywhere at this stage. You know, the net-net is, you know, we're used to competition. We want others to invest in infrastructure. We're not trying to stop that in any way. We thrive in those sort of circumstances. I think that's good for the UK as a whole. We're very confident in the investments we're making. We're confident that those are the right ones for our business and that will allow us to continue to grow going forward.
Thank you.